and welcome to another episode of Ibiza Unlocked podcast. Today we're talking to Malcolm Geary. Malcolm Geary has a very illustrious career in TV. He's the executive producer of BAFTA, and he was also the executive producer of The Brits for 10 years. Malcolm is also the man behind the film Ibiza the Silent Movie. He came up with the idea around 10 years ago, and it's so beautiful to see it finally come to fruition.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine and dandy. How are you guys?
Yeah, I'm sitting here with Nick.
Hi, Malcolm. I think I'm a bit healthier than Howard today, actually. I wasn't at Fort Worth Orange yesterday, and I saw the other adventures, so...
Did you have a bit of a night there, Howard?
I did, and I got kidnapped by two young fillies and taken back to a villa in the middle of nowhere. And there was a very elaborate rescue mission at 5 o'clock this morning. So I'm here. I'm here in body, but not in mind.
I'm very impressed that you made it. And
I wouldn't have missed it for the world, my friend. Wouldn't have missed it for the world. Because first and foremost, I want to thank you for your time. And I know you're busy, very, very busy. And it's really super cool that you've allowed me to do this. So the idea is you do your bit. Managed to get Julian fitted in yesterday at some point. So the idea is you're going to do your bit first, then it leads into Julian, then it leads into Norman.
That's fantastic.
Perfect. But it has to start with the man that had the idea, the brainchild, you know?
I like it, Howard.
Thank you very much. Right, so no swearing. Thank you. Thanks again for taking the time to talk to us. And what we're talking about today is obviously the basis of the conversation is about Ibiza the Silent Movie. But before we go into that, I'd like to touch on some of your background, because obviously you're very well known in TV, in the industry for the BAFTAs, obviously executive producer of the BAFTA. Very well done on that. But also on top of that, going back in time, you created The Tube, which then led on to The Word. Is that correct?
Yeah, I wasn't actually involved in The Word, but I'm very happy to say that I was the man behind The Tube. And I guess, we thought The Tube would run for 6 weeks. It ran for nearly 6 years, sold all over the world. And I think despite all the cynics who said, oh, you'll never get any of the big stars to come to Newcastle, we had every major star in the world, from Miles Davis to... Tina Turner, to U2, I mean, everybody, Prince, made the trek north to Geordie Land, and plugged in and played and got their rocks off, and it was a great experience. And then after The Tube, moved down to London from Newcastle and spent the rest of my life making TV programs, especially music, and did a show called The White Room, which I was very proud of, because again we had some amazing collaborations on there: Stevie Wonder, David Bowie, Lou Reed, Iggy Pop. Oasis became a kind of house band because it was in the middle of Britpop. So I think Oasis were just on about every other show, along with Blur. And it was a great experience. And then I got asked to produce The Brits, which is like the English Grammys, if you will, the British Music Awards, which was on its knees because it had a disastrous year with Sam Fox and Mick Fleetwood, which some of you might remember.
Yes.
And I was brought in as kind of Red Adair, if you will, to try and repair it. And we had an amazing run, including the famous Michael Jackson episode where Jarvis Cocker invaded the stage, and Spice Girls, where Jerry put on the Union Jack dress, and took it from 2 million viewers to 11 million viewers. And then, as you said, Howard has started to produce the BAFTAs, which again, at that point, was struggling. It was a very small event on a little channel which no longer exists. And we've been producing the BAFTAs now for 20 years.
Wow. Well, you've done a great job turning that around from what it was.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, it's been great. We got it on the BBC One, and the big move with the BAFTAs was to, it used to be after the Oscars, and basically nobody gave a damn, not least the movie companies, about getting their artists on it. When we moved it before the Oscars, and we got it on the BBC One, it suddenly became a very important part of their kind of marketing campaign leading up to the Academy Awards. So, yeah, that's been a great experience. And then got involved with doing a lot of specials. And it was about probably 7 years ago now that I had the idea of doing something on Ibiza.
And this is very, very interesting, because we spoke about this over a beer a couple of months ago, and he was in Detroit to go down to meet Aretha Franklin. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, I mean, I had the idea. I basically, my background with Aretha was from, you know, being a school teacher in Sunderland, just outside of Sunderland, in a colliery village. I used to go to a very trendy shop in Sunderland called Sergeant Pepper's, where they sold kind of trendy jeans and shirts and things, and became friends with the two owners. The two lads who owned the shop did extremely well for themselves, made a lot of money. And they started going to this island, which I'd never really heard of, called Ibiza. This is years ago now, I'm talking about, you know, a million years ago. And the one thing I remember them saying when they came back is, oh, Malcolm, you've got to go. It's an amazing place. It's difficult to get to, because then, you know, there wasn't a transport link. And they said, but, you know, it's amazing, because you've got hippies there, you've got ex-Vietnam vets hanging out, and all kinds of, you know, artistic people, lots of, as they would describe them, lots of homosexuals. And I had this image about ahead of this kind of island of a place that, you know, anybody could go to without any pressure, if you were, you know, inverted commas, an outsider. And then I never managed to get there until when we were producing The Tube, when I was doing The Tube, I struck up a good relationship with Queen, the band Queen, and we filmed some of their very early concerts at Milton Keynes, and got to know Freddie and Brian and Jim Beach, their manager, very well. And Queen and Freddie was invited to do the theme tune for the Barcelona, for the Spanish Olympics. And he... In true Freddie Mercury style, he decided that he wanted to do this with a very famous and very large Spanish diva, or operatic diva, called Montserrat Caballé. And where did he want to shoot the video? Not in the opera house in Madrid or Barcelona. He wanted to shoot it in the Coup Club.
he had good taste, Freddie Mercury.
He did. And anyway, we helped with the filming of that. My director went out and did it. Anyway, I thought, oh, this is a great chance to finally check out this, the White Island, as I heard it being called. And went out, and it was when the clubs had no roofs, so the Coup Club was still open air. And I think at the time, it then became Privilege, of course, but at the time, it was the biggest club in the world. And we shot this video of Freddie and Montserrat Caballé doing this epic song called Barcelona. And you know, everybody went back to Pike's Hotel, I'm sure your listeners will know about, a legendary hotel run by Tony Pike, who's no longer sadly with us, R.I.P. Tony. Much enjoyment was had by many people, and I just, from that day on, obviously it was a hell of an introduction to the island, but I just kind of thought, there's something magical about this place, I don't know what it is. Spent the next couple of days just driving around, checking the place out, and the thing that got me was everywhere you went, there was music. The cafes, you went to a tiny little cafe, just out in San Antonio called Café Del Mar, which at that time nobody had really discovered. It was before it became famous. And sat outside watching the sun go down with this guy called Jose Padilla, a DJ, mixing, you know, Charlie Mingus and Jacques Lissier with bits of AC/DC and flamenco guitar. And it was like, this is just amazing. This is really, you know, there's something about this place. And you went to a club and heard the most amazing, you know, mix of music there. And it just seemed to me that there was something very unique about the place. Wind the tape forward, and I ended up shooting lots of concerts and events on the island, from, you know, Grace Jones, Faithless, and the list goes on and on and on. We did an amazing show up in the old, at the old zoo, the old disbanded zoo up in the hills, all paid for by Lynx aftershave.
I was at that gig. Was you, that you? That you was the executive producer of that?
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
And Grace Jones, she sung, and after every track, she changed, got changed behind the speaker, didn't she?
Every at the end of every track, she went back and came out with a new costume. And the hats got bigger and bigger and bigger.
And I think she ended up in a suit that was made out of vinyl, wasn't it? Vinyl records, 12 inches.
She did. You've got a better memory than me, Howard.
Great gig. So well done on that. You had Chaka Khan that day as well.
Chaka Khan.
Yeah.
And you know, the amazing thing was, because it was sponsored by Lynx, who had lots of money, when you first went into the entrance of the old zoo, the pathway leading up to where the gig finally was, they'd covered the entire pathway with petals from flowers. So it was like walking into kind of like a Disneyland. And again, it just kind of summed up Ibiza. I thought, you know, where else would you get something like this? And then, you know, you go and listen to, you know, Chaka Khan and Grace Jones. And it's like in the middle of the woods, and the sun going down. It's absolutely magic.
It was a beautiful day. I remember it well.
It was kind of the fact that, you know, I've always been obsessed with places that are soaked, if you like, not just in sunshine, but soaked in music. And the combination of that, the soundtrack to the island, and also the fact that for some reason, you know, why was it that this island attracted not only great music and musicians, and, you know, from, you know, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Marley, all these people used to go out and hang out there in the day, but also the fact that it was so open-minded, and that it not only tolerated outsiders, be they hippies or beatniks or, you know, Vietnam vets who got spat on when they came back into the States, and then left and holed up in some of the bars and hotels in Ibiza. Why was it that it was this island? Why was it not Minorca? Or why was it not Corsica? Or why was it not Malta? What was it that what was the chemistry that, and that this really bugged me, and it intrigued me as to why it was that this tiny little rock in the Mediterranean not only had such an incredible powerful music diaspora, if you like, around the world. I mean, look now, you can't walk into any coffee bar or any trendy hotel reception or any hairdressers, and what you're going to hear Café Del Mar or that kind of Balearic music. It's everywhere, you know, whether you go to Tokyo or you go to LA or you go to Florida or Rio, you're going to hear that mix of music. But I first heard it sitting outside Café Del Mar back in 1980, whatever it was, 84, hearing it live, and this guy mixing, you know, flamenco and heavy metal. As the sun went down. So that was really the inspiration behind the film. I've kind of answered that question, what is it? And I did a bit of research, and I couldn't find anything. No documentaries, no films about the history of the island or why it was that this magic element was there, and yet it wasn't in other islands in the Mediterranean. The only stuff that was on TV was stuff like, which you might remember, Ibiza Uncovered.
Yeah. Yeah, that was terrible, wasn't it?
Which was a kind of, you know, really dumbed down reality show of people, you know, shagging, pill topping, you know, doing everything. And yes, some of that went on the island, of course it did. But if you watch the Beatles Uncovered, you think that the entire population of the island, you know, from north to south, east to west, was doing that 7/24. And it just wasn't true. And it certainly isn't true now. And it wasn't true then. And it just seemed to me that was a real sadness, that you had this magical place, you know, 2 hours away from London, 2.5 hours away from Newcastle. And yet there wasn't anything on that kind of showed the real side of the island. And that was really when I thought, you know, there's an opportunity here to do something very special.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've had a lot of experience on the island over the years, as you just said. And I mean, loads of stuff you just reeled off there. And I wasn't aware about the Freddie Mercury concept that you worked on in Privilege, so that must have been a really, really super cool experience. And so when you was in Detroit, you was on your way to speak to Aretha Franklin, is that correct? Because you was about to make a film about her life, no?
Yeah, so basically we wind the tape forward now to only a few years back, probably 4 years, so. And I was holed up in Detroit, waiting to get an interview with Aretha. Had spent the Sunday morning in the famous church where she grew up, and that blew me away. And I was struck by just how very, very sad Detroit was. The thing that really shocked me was the fact that. And everybody knows Detroit basically went bankrupt, and that, you know, they cut the electricity off at 10 o'clock at night, and, you know, some of the hospitals couldn't work, and the Ford Motor Company had disappeared and gone bust down there. And it was just a tragic and incredible, I mean, kind of third world poverty, if I'm honest. Came back to London, switched on the TV, and there was a documentary on called Requiem for Detroit. And the opening sequence was basically kind of driving around Detroit, looking at all of this dereliction and poverty and, you know, kind of very sad scenes. Cut to an amazing Eminem track. And Eminem, again, hails from that part of the country. And it blew me away. It was like, whoa. This was really powerful, and it was just a brilliant documentary. So I waited till the end to see who directed it, and up came Julian Temple's name. And I thought, whoa, if he can do that about a city, I wonder if he could do it about an island, if he could capture, you know, that magic, albeit a very sad magic, of what was happening in Detroit. Could he get his head around what was happening in Ibiza? And obviously Ibiza, you know, more recently when I've been going there, I've seen, you know, major, major things changing on the island. Some good, some not so good. And to be honest, I've actually talked to several directors. One very famous Hollywood director who is passionate about music. I probably shouldn't say his name. Nobody really got it. Nobody, I didn't feel confident that they understood what it was. One of the directors, there was a regular visit to the island, but wanted to focus just on the clubbing scene. And I wasn't interested in that because there'd been lots of stuff on Channel 4 and MTV about, you know, Pete Tong and Oakenfold and all the guys. I thought, well, that's been done. We know that story. But, you know, we want to delve a bit deeper than that. And despite having a few drinks and lunches with various people, I didn't feel it got it. So when I watched Wrecking for Detroit, I've got to meet up with Julian. Happened to be working with Richard and Andrew at the time, on a few ideas, and they said, oh, we've just finished working with Julian Temple on a film with about Wilco Johnson from Dr. Feelgood. Amazing, amazing Wilco.
I love that film. It's one of my favourite Julian Temple films. Fantastic.
It's terrific. And I said, oh, let's get together. I've met Julian years ago, back in the 80s when he was making pop videos, and then he made Absolute Beginners with David Bowie, the movie. So, long story short, had met up with Julian and started to do the pitch with him. And I said, have you been on the island? He said, yeah. I said, are you sure? He didn't seem very sure that you had been on the island. And I said, yeah, I've been. And I said, are you in? He said, I'm not into house music or dance music really, Mark. I'm a bit of a punk, as you know. I said, yeah. And I said, that doesn't matter. I don't care about that, Julian. What do you think? And kind of did my little pitch to him. And I could see him thinking about it. And he said, well, you know, the way I work, you know, it'll be quite an authored piece. And I said, yeah, that's okay, don't worry. And then he just said, yeah. I'm in. And I don't think we'd even finished Prawn Cocktail.
You obviously gave him a good pitch. It was a good pitch.
Yeah. And I was like, fantastic. Let's do this. And and then of course, you know, having had the idea, got a terrific director on board, then you've got to go out and raise the money. Literally the next day, I was in the BBC talking to Jan Ringhusband, who's the head of music there.
Fantastic lady, very, very good. A lot of respect for her.
Amazing woman, and I knew that she loved Julian's work. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to go for it. So I just said, you know, blah, 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 Ibiza, a story, Julian Temple. And she said, oh my God, she said, this is perfect. We're going to do a whole season of dance music on the BBC in the autumn of next year. This can be the jewel in the crown, Morgan. And she basically commissioned it on the spot. And to have the BBC involved meant that when you could then go out and talk to other people about raising the money, and it's obviously a great calling card if you've already got the BBC on the loop. So it was having struggled with the idea for about, as I say, God, 5 years then, 4 years, everything started to fall into place really, really, really quickly. Raising the rest of the money was tricky because it wasn't like you're making a documentary about Whitney Houston or Michael Jackson, or, you know, it wasn't the easiest sell to a financier, because again, if you haven't been on the island, you know, everybody thinks, oh, it's going to be a documentary about clubbing or drug taking, or, you know, this kind of caricature that frustratingly and rather annoyingly people have, that's all the island is about. And it was only when we met up with the guys from Silver Wheel, a guy called Ian there, who said, look, this is a really interesting proposition. And we met up with the whole team, did the pitch, and they came on board for the rest of the money. And that was it. It was all systems go. And it's taken a while. We missed the dance season on BBC by a year. let's say Julian isn't known for being the fastest operator in that sort of business, but anyway, we've delivered it, and I'm really thrilled with the outcome.
I mean, look, the end result, I'm very biased because as you know, I worked on it alongside you, which was a real honour and a privilege. So thanks for the opportunity for that, Malcolm. And I am absolutely in love with the film. The end result is very unique, I feel. It has a great message. It tells the story of the island. And it's a very unique film. As Julian said, it's the loudest silent movie ever made.
Well, that's right. I think, you know, the other bit of the jigsaw, which for me was as important, almost if not more important than who was going to direct it, was who was going to curate and the music and do the soundtrack for the film. Because, you know, the thing that got me pregnant with Ibiza in the first place was the music. And you know, we talked about various people being involved in the music, and I struck up a relationship with an old friend of mine called David Levy, who was like one of the top agents on the planet in that world. He looks after Pete Tong and Norman Cook and a whole bunch of people. And David was invaluable, and he lives on the island, invaluable in opening doors, you know, to clubs and places that we would probably have struggled to get access to, because he's got huge respect on the island. And David suggested one or two names of people, you know, and we talked to them, and we didn't get very far. Either they didn't get the idea, or they were just too busy, or whatever. And it was really only by, we were kind of struggling a little bit, I'll be honest. And I said, this is mad, you know, it's got to be the music in this film is like crucial, absolutely crucial. And, you know, we've got to nail this. And I'd known Norman for years and years and years. In fact, when we were producing The Tube, we used to do these little films in Belfast and Glasgow and, you know, New Orleans and Nashville and Kingston, Jamaica. And we did one in Hull, of all places. Because it was an actual, really happening music scene there in the 80s. And we shot this band who were unsigned at the time called the House Martins. and you know, who was in the band? A very young, very skinny Norman Cook.
Bass player. Yeah, he was the bass player, wasn't he?
Yeah. And so I'd go a long way with Norman. And then, because, you know, when he was with Zoe, had spent, you know, some great time down at his house in Brighton and Hove, and it was I think it was Corda Marshall, who was a very fantastic music executive, I think working for BMG at the moment. It was Corda who we were talking about. He was really interested in the Ibiza film, but they didn't get involved in the end. But it was a conversation with him, and I said, he said, who's going to do the music? And I said, oh, I'm struggling a little bit, to be honest. Doing, you know, and he said, oh, well, we just acquired the back catalogue of Norman Cook's record label, Skink, I think it's called.
That's correct.
And he said, what about Norman? And I just thought, like, oh my God, you know, when something's been just, you know, staring you in the face, and you just go and see it. And I was like, oh my God, I said, calling you, I don't know, that's, yes, he's the perfect man. He is the perfect man. So I rang up David, I knew David was his agent, and I've known Gary, who's Gary Blackburn, who's his manager, wonderful man, for years and years. Gary used to come up with and plug me as a plugger on the tube, and, you know, give me free records out the back of his boot of his Mini, and David said, that's an inspired idea. Why didn't we think that? I said, David, I have no idea. You know, you're rubbish and I'm rubbish. And you represent it as well.
I mean, look at the duo, you know, Julian Temple and Fatboy Slim. You know, it was meant to be. So, you know.
It was a marriage made in heaven. And you know, we went down to see Norman at this lovely house in, you know, the south coast of England. And again, rather like the experience with Jan at the BBC, started to pitch him. Julian came with me and we started to do the pitch. I remember Julian being quite nervous, which was interesting. And we literally got, I don't know, 10 minutes into the pitch. And Norman said, look, guys, this is amazing. Of course, I'm on board for it. let's just get out. Let's go and get some lunch and have a drink and talk about what we're going to do. And it was like, what? And Gary was looking at me like, well, I think we need to have a proper meeting. I was like,
we need to talk about terms and conditions.
Yeah, let's go and have some lunch. And he owns this little kind of cafe in Brighton, just near where he lives. It's like a classic Teesside, you know, cafe selling Brighton rock and stuff. And we sat there for about 3 hours, and Julian, and there's obvious, Julian and Norman sat at the end of the table, and you could just see them firing off ideas. It was brilliant to watch. It's such a great memory, I've got a great visual of that, in this kind of greasy spoon and cafe in Brighton.
Well, it's two artists, but bouncing around ideas, you know, the big names.
I just thought, you know what, this is going to work. This is going to work.
And you know what? It did work, and it has worked. And now the end result is for all to see. It was released on the cinemas, general release on the 5th of July. We had the world premiere at Glastonbury, which was fantastic, at Cinema Armageddon. We raised a glass there with the crew, didn't we?
We did indeed. And I think the interesting thing about the film is it's like, I think, Nick, you used a brilliant word when you reviewed the film after the screening on Ibiza, and I told Julian this, and he loved it. And I said, you know, a dear friend of mine called Nick, who's a brilliant journalist living on the island, actually said he felt the film was an intervention. And it just really kind of summed it up beautifully, because it is controversial, and it has polarized one or two people. Because it's a real gloves off, you know. It doesn't pull any punches at all. It says it how it is. One or two people who I know, no names are Patrio, who you guys will both know, who are very active on the island and do a lot of work there. When they first saw it, were like, "Ooh, not sure about this." And then since then, it's interesting. I was talking to one of them last week, and he said, "You know what? I've watched it again. I really get it. I think the first time I saw it, I think because everybody's expecting it to be a documentary about clubbing or EDM or about, you know, only the last 30, 40 years on the island, and that it's not. It's 2,000 year history from the Phoenicians to Fat Boy Slim." I think that when you first watch it, it's like, whoa, you know, this is a bit of a culture shock because it's not what I was expecting to see. And because it makes some pretty strong statements about what, you know, the health warning, it's like a health warning that the island has at the moment about, you know, the number of tourists, the VIP culture, the influx of certain possibly undesirable factors on the island, and the increasing grip of the state and the some of the more powerful figures on the island, that you've lost, you know, there's a sadness to having lost. I mean, I remember going to some amazing parties, you know, on the beaches, you know, in the north of the island, and watching the sun come up in, you know, in various places, in which I know you guys have both enjoyed, and all that got shut down, you know, just absolutely. I remember in one summer, you know, the police were very aggressive and very active, and all those sort of impromptu pop-up events that used to take place, you know, sometimes with big main DJs, but they just rock up and start playing in the middle of nowhere. Or little bars that suddenly, you know, became kind of secret venues if you knew about them. All that disappeared almost overnight, you know, in one summer. It was hellish. And that was the first sign I got of, ooh, there's something changing here in the kind of, you know, the mood music of the island. And, you know, the velvet ropes got longer and longer. And unless you knew somebody, or you had money, or you're on the guest list, you weren't going to get in there unless you were going to part with, you know, 80 euros. And then if you did good, get in there, then you're going to spend 15 euros on a beer. And it's like, wow, you know, what's this going to what's this going to do, you know? Instead of just a couple of super yachts in the harbour, there'd be 20 super yachts, and then 30 super yachts, and then 50 super yachts. And, you know, this tiny little rock kind of handle it, you know? But the great thing about the film, and this is where there's real redemption, I think, in the movie, is the island's been through this many times before. It's been invaded by whether it's Phoenicians or it's Romans or it's Moors or it's Francos or the Nazis. It seems to have this incredible ability to reboot and take stock, take a breath and repair itself and get back to a kind of default position of being one of the most amazing places on the planet.
Yes, you hit the nail on the head. You know, so much over the history of this island, so many different things have happened, which the film touches on. You know, the Phoenicians, as you mentioned, the Romans, the pirate era, the Moorish era. It does really cover everything in a 90-minute timeline. And I think that this film will, my personal opinion, this film, it will become a very much a cult film. It's basically art in an audio and visual sense. And as I said to Norman Cook, I feel that the audio, the selection of tracks that he made, for want of a better phrase, cuddles, blankets the visual and carries it through perfectly.
That's a lovely way to put it. And I think, you know, I mean, Norman... The great thing about Norman is he's not only a great DJ, he's an incredible musicologist. And, you know, if you listen to his music over the different kind of chapters of his musical career, you know, he's a man who's prepared to take risks and has done some incredibly groundbreaking stuff. And I think the challenge, especially as it was a silent movie, the soundtrack, you know, was stage center. We had to get it right because there was no dialogue. So everything rested on Norman's shoulders in terms of, you know, park the visuals, which was Julian's responsibility, you know, in terms of driving the movie from, you know, beginning, middle and end, all that pressure was on Norman's shoulders. So, you know, it was a real challenge for him and he hadn't done it before. And my God, did he rise to that challenge? You know, I mean, sitting in that field in Glastonbury with, you know, 4,000, 5,000 people sitting in burnt out Cadillacs and Chinook helicopters. And
it was a bit of a spectacle, and that's not just the film. It was amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, the biggest screen in Europe, and it was like a silent disco, so everybody had headphones on, so you could really hear the sound quality and just what Norman had done in terms of the mix. And the dub and the audio, and you know, Richard Conway is one of the two producers. His background is post production, and you know, he did a brilliant job on the mix as well. I it just blew me away. It was, you know, I've been spoilt in my life to have some incredible experiences sitting in that field in Glastonbury. And the film was introduced by Michael Eavis, you know, the man who started Glastonbury and. A wonderful, wonderful national treasure of a man, you know, introduced the film. And it was like, wow. And it was a beautiful, beautiful summer's evening. And I don't know, I just sat there feeling, you know, incredibly proud of, you know, what Julian and Norman and Richard and Andrew and everybody who'd worked on the film in any shape or form had done. And I think, you know, love it or hate it, you certainly can't ignore that movie.
you hit the nail on the head, as Julian calls it again, the loudest silent movie ever made. And yeah, no, it was a privilege and honour to work on the film, but also to be there for the world premiere. So what can we expect from the film now? As I said, general release 5th of July. And then it's going to go around the world. It's going to be translated into other languages. Is that correct?
Well, it gets its premiere on the BBC in August, so it's going to get a TV premiere on BBC. It's got a prime time slot and then on the BBC, I was actually with Jan yesterday, the head of music from the BBC, and I know they're just getting ready to roll out their PR campaign for the TV premiere, and then it'll go back. We're looking at back into the screens, back into the cinema in the autumn. And the thing that I'm really excited about, obviously I'm really excited about being on television, but the thing that really excites me is we did that private screening on the island, you know, for people like yourselves and to tie in with the IMS, the music conference that's held there every year. But we haven't had a public screening. And what really excites me is I'm desperate to have and I know everybody else is, David, and you, Howard, anybody who's been involved with the island, you know, involved with the film in any shape or form, you know, I'd love us to put an event on, ideally September, October, if it's possible, it might be too short notice, on the island that anybody can come along to and watch the film. And I think, you know, we need to make that special. We need to find a great venue for it. I know David's got somewhere in mind already. But I think that, for me, that would be a real thrill. And in a funny way, it would kind of almost complete the circle, if you will, from this journey from watching Freddie Mercury in the Ku Klux in 1987 or in 88, whenever it was, right the way up to now.
Well, I have to say, you know, from this being your brainchild, you say like 10 years ago, for it now to come to fruition, I have to say congratulations, because it's something very, very special. So well done.
Well, thank you, Howard. And, you know, it just would not have been remotely possible without all of the will. I remember getting in touch with Nick when we were just starting the research on the island, and I said, Nick, you know, just do me a download, you know. I've watched Nick's career and I love his writing, and the fact that I knew he loved the island and had decided to live there, you know, which makes puts a whole colour on it. And I just said, send me an email, Nick, just download me some thoughts, anything, you know, just stream of consciousness, you know, a whole bunch of stuff, just give me your thoughts on, you know. And he did this, I remember, Nick, you've probably forgotten about this, he did this really great email with some thoughts and inspirations. And it was really, it was like a shot of vitamin C in my arm, because I was like, yeah, I'm definitely right. Because you doubt yourself all the time. You doubt, you're like, am I right? Is this just me? Is this, you know? And when I got that email from you, Nick, and that, you know, you've got a credit on the movie, and quite properly, you know, it just convinced me, yeah, this is a great story. This is a great story. We've got to do this.
Right, well, thanks for that. I have forgotten about it, because obviously then I got the terminal cancer diagnosis after that, which kind of wiped everything else out of my mind. But no, I remember it now you mention it.
Yeah, it was just what I needed at that time. It was like a little pep talk. It was like, Malcolm, do this. You know, you're right. You know? So it's always a new sort of project. My ex-boss used to describe these projects, which are very complicated, and, you know, we've got lots of different agendas going on, lots of different people, you know, involved in it, and, you know, conflicting interests, etc., etc. My ex-boss used to call them hairy-ass projects. I hope you can broadcast that, Howard. Boy, this is one hairy-ass of a project. I tell you.
Oh, brilliant. Well, Malcolm, thank you so much for your time, and we really appreciate your thoughts on the film and explaining how it all come about. And it's been really, really nice chatting with you, and we'll be in touch soon.
And thank you for the support, guys, and you know, keep on waving the flag for the White Island.
100%, and we hope that you're going to make it over sometime this summer, or
Can't stop me.
Well, hopefully let's get to work on this On Ireland premiere, because I feel that everyone on the island needs to see this film across all generations.
Well, I think Richard is coming in. I think Richard's heading over there, and I said to him, look, you've got to reach out to David and check out you know, a couple of venues while you're there, and then if you think you've found somewhere, I'll hop on a plane and any excuse, I'll hop on a plane and come out and check them out, and let's get rolling on it and do it.
You're 100% correct, because I spoke to Richard a couple of days ago, and I'm meeting up with him on Wednesday, and me, him and David are going to go and look at a couple of venues, so I'll keep you up to speed on that, okay?
Oh, well, I'm really pleased. That's great news.
Fantastic. And Malcolm, have a great weekend, mate. Thank you so much.
And you guys, much love.
Cheers, thank you very much, Malcolm. Cheers. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Love to Barbara. Love to Barbara, Nick.
Roses. Thanks, Malcolm.
Cheers, man. Bye.
Cheers, mate. Bye. Cheers, bye.
Please send your feedback to Howard at Ibiza Unlocked, and you can also check out www.ibizaunlocked.com for all things Ibiza, from film production services to villa rentals and sales to boat charters and yacht services. All things Ibiza for a full turnkey solution. Let us unlock Ibiza for you.